Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It is now 2:30, so we will resume. And we are, as you're conscious, kind of part heard through agenda item 4. But before we return to the fray, and in so doing, I am conscious of a particular request from Captain Barker to speak. And indeed, I believe there was also a request from MCA, and then I am conscious of a need to return to Mr. Linus. But before we go to those places, I thought that I would just make some preliminary observations on the timetable and essentially progress in the light of our need to bring this hearing down at 26 at the absolute latest. Essentially, having reviewed our sort of consideration of progress on the agenda items dealt with this morning, particularly the beginning of agenda item 4, it's very clear that there is still a very substantial level of dispute and dispute at detail over the extent and effectiveness of consultation before, during and after the production of the NRA, over data sets, etc. Essentially, we're in a world where such a lot of detail is essentially still a matter of dispute that we're not, I believe, doing what a good hearing should, which is moving up to the strategic level and picking out those matters where there clearly is dispute, putting a boundary around them and reserving them into a place where they need to be adjudicated upon, and then working out what evidence is necessary to adjudicate upon them, but also then working out and essentially resolving where there are matters that might not be in immediate dispute or not, or with some further conversations between the parties might not be in dispute. So essentially what I was going to suggest that we do is this. I think in relation to the remaining items in agenda item 4, once we have heard from the parties, as I've indicated, we will hear from, my suggestion is that with those items, given the outstanding level of dispute, that they are actually, in many ways, best addressed in detail and in writing at deadline 3. And I will allow submissions to me on this approach before we move on. Because if we do that, there will be clarity over the points of detail, but we won't find ourselves using hearing time, essentially sniping with machine guns across the boundary, rather than actually focusing on the major items that we need to deal with. So that would be my initial observation to you about how we best use our time, and my suggestion then would be that we move straight to the sort of higher strategic points raised then in agenda item 5. I would also flag, whilst we're looking across the whole agenda, that agenda item 8, which is a navigation item, was included specifically because we noted that the Manston Airport applicant is an interested party, had made representations. We wanted to provide them with an opportunity to bring those representations to the table if they so wish. They haven't availed themselves of that opportunity, and so I'm content for all of that to be dealt with in writing as well. So that's another item that can fall away. So can I just very briefly hear views around the table about that potential approach to managing the remainder of today's agenda? And I'll just go round in the normal way. So if I can start with Mr. Owen.
Robbie Owen, Port of Tilbury and London Gateway. So that seems to me, and I'm sure my colleagues, to be a sensible use of time. In the adjournment, I did have a conversation with Mr. Linus, and we agreed that there should be some urgent discussions between the technical experts on the NRA, because it is a hugely technical area, as we all recognise. And so that will happen, I would hope. And we will do that as soon as possible so we can try and make some progress before deadline 3. In the meantime, You know, we're happy to focus on the higher level strategic issues, and indeed Mr. Crockett certainly wanted to make a couple of points about the NRA in that respect. I don't know whether now would be the right time or under agenda item 5.
We can, if they are speaking essentially to the kind of strategic overview, then we can deal with them in the tail end of agenda item 4 before we move on. But what I'm just going to do before we do that and invite anybody else in on 4 is just get everybody's view on the procedural approach.
Thank you, sir. That's fine.
Okay. Yeah. So if I can move around the rest of the room. Trinity House.
Thank you, sir. Trinity House, Roger Barker. Your way ahead sounds absolutely sensible to me, but like my colleague from the port side, just like to make a comment on the risk assessment and the NRA, which I believe is at strategic level, and it's where the risk assessment fits in the overall discussion we're having today.
And I did, in fact, have a note of your request to engage just before the lunch break, and you were already on my list to call. Okay. Moving then around, MCA.
Likewise, that nothing in particular. We will, as we hear some argument on 5, we will come back with our bits, but mostly it will be reflected by our stakeholders, because after all, we are statutory consultee there, which means we are required, and we are adequately consulting our other stakeholders, and most of them are present here, and most of them have got local views and knowledges of these particular matters better than us, and so we will go along with that, sir. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Anything additional from Coast Guard or no? UK Chamber, Port of London Authority.
Alex Dillastone from Whitworth Sherwood for the PLA and ESL. We are very happy with that approach, I think so. It would be useful to be able to move on through the agenda.
Speed us up. Okay. London Pilots.
Yes, Andy Syme from London Pilots. Yes, very happy with that, sir. Let's move on. Thank you.
Okay. And finally, Mr. Linus for the applicant.
Scott Linus for the applicant. Yes, sir, it would be no surprise for here. We're entirely happy with that approach. In fact, if one looks at the beginning of agenda item 5, there's a question of whether there's a reasonable prospect of technical agreement being achieved in this point. And from our point of view, it may actually help you with respect more to understand where, not so much where there's strategic levels of disagreement, but are there any levels of agreement which can be used as a starting point for a discussion?
Absolutely, and that is why I felt cutting to the chase of that.
Exactly, and for that reason, we support that approach entirely, sir.
Productive use of our time. Okay, well, in which case, let's then move to the outstanding requests that were made to speak just before the lunch break. So I'm going to come to Captain Barker first.
Thank you. Roger Barker, Trinity House. My intervention when we were talking about the NRA just before lunch was actually to support my colleagues from Estuary Services on the issue of quantification of fishing vessel data. I think it's important when we talk about quantification, we understand that what it actually means to the overall issue we're discussing, the transit of traffic between the Thanet wind farm and the coast, be it with an extension or otherwise, and the proposed extension. Fishing vessels create a problem for vessels in transit very regularly. It's very difficult to assume what he's going to do, but the mariners in the room will know that the number of times I've altered course for a fishing vessel, a minor alteration of course, and the fishing vessel will turn around and go the other way. It's what they do. The problem is if we reduce the available sea room for that manoeuvre, we've got a problem. And I think it's really important that when we look at the NRA and the details we've been discussing, and indeed the questions about a route, the area between the Thanet offshore wind farm and the Kent coast is an area of general navigation. I don't really mind whether it's called a route, a passage, a corridor, or indeed a formal routing measure. Vessels will transit through there, and as such, in that transit, we must ensure that any risk presented it can be mitigated. My job, our job at Trinity House is, if possible, to use aids to navigation to mitigate the risk. Because of the constrained sea room, it's so tight, the ability to mitigate the risk in my My opinion is very limited, and as such, I consider the risk is intolerable. But we talked a lot about the figures, about the NRA. Actually, we do continue to support the general work of the NRA, or at least we note it. The figures, as I said earlier, the risk of an incident in that passageway went from 6 originally to 1.4, and then slightly better, to 1.45 with a minor amendment of the red line boundary. The risk has gone up. And I referred earlier this morning to the national policy statement discussing the risk, and we've covered it. My passionate problem is that I really believe that when we look at qualitative elements of the risk assessment, and those are the ones that are very difficult to quantify the qualification, very difficult, because we don't know what's going to happen on the day. But I know, working with colleagues, working as a master mariner serving in the Southern North Sea for many years, and indeed, I currently, one of my jobs for Trinity House, I license deep sea pilots. I revalidate them every year in January. And the deep sea pilots, 31 of them this year, all said the same thing. The quality of bridgemanship on many of the vessels that go on is very good. Conversely, many is such that the attention to detail might not be what we would want it to be. And my concern with constrained sea room between the Thanet offshore wind farm and the coast is that if the engines are not ready for immediate manoeuvre and the fishing vessel turns around and goes the other way, and you don't have the available sea room to react accordingly, I can't use the engines because they're not ready for immediate manoeuvre, one man on the bridge or whatever, then we have a problem. So my passionate statement from absolute experience is, and it is qualified by talking to deep sea pilots and indeed harbour pilots, is that the risk is intolerable. I'm slightly concerned that many issues of technicalities that we've been discussing today don't really change that measure. The quantitative risk assessment, which has been delivered by the applicants, is noted. The figures I've said is noted. The only element of qualitative risk assessment really was the simulation study, as we discussed at issue specific area 2, and that was in some ways questionable because of the people involved, but it was an element of qualitative risk assessment. And in that case, there was one accident incident within 1 in 14 years. That's very tight. But to go down to what the quantitative risk assessment has said, down to 1 to 4.5, I really believe is just not acceptable. And as such, through a lot of experience, both, as I say, talking to locals and deep sea pilots who have the current live experience of what is going on other vessels, I think we should, in my opinion, not lose focus on that risk. Thanks very much.
Okay. Now, Mr. Owen, I'm conscious that you wanted to bring your expert in.
Thank you, sir. So if I can just ask Mr. Crockett to take the microphone.
Yes, I think the real point I think that we wanted to get across in relation to Captain Barker's point as well, and I think it is only really a strategic level one, is the importance of looking at the future. Section 6 of the NRA is brief, admirably brief, but it doesn't really give the reader an insight into what sort of ships are likely to come in the future. And I think that is one of our key concerns, is at the strategic level, that we have ships that are quite large at the moment. What are they going to look like in 5 or 10 years' time? And what is the vessel traffic mix going to look like in a few years' time, when ever larger ships are using the Sunk and the main route into the Thames Estuary? And will in the future there be a pressure on changing the vessel traffic mix so that larger ships which currently go to the Sunk will need to come inshore? And if we constrain the maritime access to the port, we may regret it later. I mean, I think it's really just getting across this idea that we're of the firm opinion that demand has not been considered in a way that actually understands the complexity of how the London Gateway, in particular, and Tilbury, in the future, will develop. And it's worth noting that in the past, although there's a perception, and perhaps I'm guilty as well, is that the Port of Tilbury handles smaller ships. In the past, it has actually handled ships, when it has to, of over 340 metres. I think the S-class ship has actually been into Tilbury. Correct me if I'm wrong, anybody, but I believe it has in the past when there's been the Sovereign Maersk came into the North Hope container terminal. So we shouldn't fail to understand that not only has Gateway got potential to handle larger ships, but so has Tilbury, and I think that's probably enough to say on that. So it's the message of demand.
Okay. Is there anybody else with high-level observations on the remainder of four before I return to Mr. Linus for his right of reply? No. Mr. Linus.
Scott Linus for the applicant. Let's deal with that final point, if I may, very, very briefly. You'll recall, sir, that the first round of questions that was issued by the panel specifically asked for information on this from the interested parties. And that information hasn't been provided on ships coming in the future. For our part, we have taken into account future vessel movements within the NRA, and it's page 65, section 6.3, is the main reference by allowing for 10% increase. And the reason for that is explained. I won't go into detail. So future vessel movement has been allowed. The information that we have seen from the ports are contained in their deadline two response. We've also a couple of tables about trade levels, and table two relates to vessels. But at this stage anyway, we don't see that information as directly helpful to the issues that have been raised by the panel, because it doesn't help with the number and nature of vessels that will be travelling along the inshore route in particular. It may give us information about intended vessels that might be using the ports, but it's not directly relevant to the nature of the vessel traffic that will be along the inshore route. And as I said, we have taken these matters into account, and I made an allowance for that within the NRA. The second point that I'd like to deal with is in relation to the Trinity House observations. And all I would say in response to that is that we have included specifically within our information data on fishing vessels, which has been fed into our work. And as I mentioned earlier on, it was specifically identified as a source of one of the highest risk hazards, and was taken into account as part of the wider NRA applying guidance, which is of direct relevance and agreed to be of direct relevance, and led to results showing that we were in the LARP range. And again, I don't want to repeat the point too often, but we haven't seen a specific disagreement as to why the process that was followed within the NRA is wrong as far as the individual elements of the judgments and the expert judgments are concerned. That's just the second point. And the final point I'd like to make on this item, well, there's two sub-points relating to guidance. And the first one relates about to the involvement of experts. It was a matter that was raised earlier on. And it was the reference to the IMO guidance on formal safety assessment in the IMO rulemaking process. And again, we can deal with this further in writing, as you suggest, sir, but just one matter to note is that guidance obviously applies to the IMO rulemaking process, and we say that is relevant context in the sense that where it discusses involvement of experts and the level of agreement being recorded, it's relevant to note that that's in the context of this rulemaking process, where you might anticipate experts from different constituencies contributing to the promulgation of a rule. And we can understand, perhaps in that circumstance, the particular guidance was being offered. But we don't understand there to be specific guidance about the development of a project going through processes such as the NSIP process, which specifically requires any form of peer review in the way that has been suggested. If anything, the process that is set out involves consultation with experts from consultation bodies. And in section 4 of the NRA, we have recorded not only who was consulted, but the nature of the consultation and where that is actually reflected in the NRA. So to the extent that issues were raised, we've gone through the process of identifying specific part in the NRA where those issues have been addressed. So we say, insofar as there is any suggestion that we ought to record the outcome of the consultation that's taken place, we say that has been adequately reflected within the NRA, within the NRA itself. And one final point is, as far as experts are concerned, there has been internal expertise within Marico, which has looked at the NRA before it has gone out through consultation with the other parties. So there has been a deep level of expert involvement in the preparation of the NRA. The other point on guidance I was wanting to raise, just a point that was raised, I think, by ESL on MGN 543 and the survey periods. And there was a reference to recommendation for more extensive survey periods. And I think I just want to raise the point that one has to be careful when looking at MGN 543 as to what that paragraph says. And it's the guidance relates not only to the duration of the survey itself, but its age by reference to the timing of the environmental statement. So an Annex 1, the guidance relating to traffic surveys says it should be undertaken within 12 months prior to the submission of the ES, and it should include at least 28 days duration. But then it goes on to say, and I think this is a paragraph that's being referred to, if deemed necessary to cover seasonal variations, peak times, or perceived future traffic trends, the survey period may be extended to a maximum of 24 months. That's not suggesting you need to conduct further survey work. It's suggesting that the period within which the survey work can be taken can be longer if it's considered necessary to achieve that. So we don't interpret that aspect of the guidance as somehow requiring us to go beyond the 28 days it was carried out.
Now, just to be clear there on that final point then, the 24 months is a direct comparable with the 12 months.
So exactly. It's
essentially saying that you should provide the survey input 12 months prior to the finalisation of the environmental statement, but that can be extended under certain circumstances to 24 months.
Scott Lannis for Vattenfall, yes, sir.
And that's your submission about what that
means.
It doesn't
require you to carry out further survey work itself. It's about the vintage of the surveys, essentially.
Yeah, okay, fine. Now, Mr. Owen, on that point.
So if I may, without seeking to delay us unduly, if I could just come back on that whole subject of growth, because Mr. Linus helpfully referred to the 10% allowance, if I can call it that, included in the navigation risk assessment. It'd be helpful to understand why that figure is considered appropriate in the specific circumstances of this case, where you have two ports, both of which now have consent for substantial expansions. I mentioned earlier, London Gateway has consent and a declaration and an intent to build out to that consent of 3.5 million TEU a year. The last figures were 1.3 million, so there's a way to go. Similarly, we now know that Tilbury 2 has consent, contractors have been appointed, and construction will start as soon as the DCO comes into force in 21 days' time. So against that specific background, it's unclear to me why 10% is considered an appropriate allowance for growth, because this isn't incremental growth we're talking about here in relation to which 10% might be an appropriate figure. This is considerably more than incremental growth, and I refer back to our deadline 2 submissions that demonstrated that from 2016 to 2018, there was a combined growth between both ports of 22.5%. The end of the study period for the NRA, which informed the growth assumptions, was 2016, as I understand it. So in the 2 years after that, you've got a substantial growth of 22.5%. So it does seem to us that given the specific circumstances of this, of these two ports and the estuary, that the assumptions, yeah, the input factors, if you like, to the NRA do need revisiting and are just not adequate to deal with the recent and immediately anticipated increase in traffic, let alone to deal with the kind of issues that Mr. Crockett referred to about us not knowing quite what's going to happen in the future about size of vessels.
Okay. Now, in fairness, I do need to just bring that back over the table to Mr. Linus, and then I propose to bring this item to an end. Mr. Linus.
Scott Linus for Vattenfall. Yes, I mean, the NRA explains that the 10% was allowed for because although there was a recognition that when looked at national statistics of vessel movements, there'd been a downturn in the shipping industry, that there would be, that would be offset by a localised increase, and reliance was placed upon the PLA's Thames Vision project, which forecast trade growth over a 20-year period up to 2035, and concluded that during the life of the project, interport trade would increase from 45 million tonnes between 56 and 93 million tonnes per year. So the allowance was made for local increases in trade. Obviously, at that time, the specific consent that's been granted today wasn't going to be taken into account in that sense, but clearly forecast increases in trade through the Thames Vision project were taken into account, reaching up 10%. The only other point I would make is that we understand that the ports have put these figures about projected growth in the ports, but again, I come back to my point, that does not necessarily assist you in understanding where those ships are going to be travelling as far as the inshore route specifically is concerned. So as we take the point that there may be a suggestion of growth as far as the ports are concerned, until there's some suggestion from the ports about where these ships are actually going to go, particularly along the inshore route that's an issue, it's difficult to know where exactly that point's going to going to take them.
Okay, I note all of those points. Now, in bringing agenda item 4 to a close, I do think we have essentially some outstanding tasks, which are in written representations by deadline 3, please, from all parties gathered here, your detailed technical responses to the agenda items framed out there, focusing on the matters that are still in technical dispute, but I think also productively identifying what, if any, solution you believe there might be to the technical dispute that remains. So in other words, yes, it helps us immensely to know that you believe that a certain matter has not been correctly delivered, but it would assist us even more to know if, in your view, something can be done about that. I would like that to be kind of turned to by all interested parties around the table by the deadline. But I'm actually going to make a suggestion that in the period before the deadline, that the applicant might make contact with yourselves and essentially start to scope out the degree to which a statement of common ground process on those matters might usefully be taken forward. Now, we need to give some consideration as to a deadline at which such a statement might then come in, because my guess would be that it will be all that can be humanly achieved to actually to document the outstanding concerns and also document potential routes forward by deadline 3, and to also require the conclusion of a statement of common ground by then is just not humanly possible, but my sort of starting proposition would be that I would deadline 4 feels very, very late.
Scott Lennon for the applicant. Sir, yes, we understand that by deadline 3, it's going to be helpful to you to at least have an update on where the parties are. Meetings have actually taken place already last week. I've spoken with Mr. Owen to try and set up meetings between the experts, respective experts, to take place as a matter of urgency to see what progress had been made. And we have had useful meetings with the ports already last week. As for the other parties, I repeat what I said earlier, we are committed to maintaining discussions, but we need to know that we are entering into those discussions. If we're entering into them with an open mind, we need to make sure the other parties are doing the same thing, and we're not going to arrive at a meeting to be said our position is that we want to take out 50% of your red line boundary. There's going to be a genuine attempt to reach an agreement, and as I've said also earlier, we'll be keen to make sure that sort of what I've called rules of engagement can be established as part of these meetings very quickly. So we entirely agree. We want to make these meetings productive, and we anticipate that by deadline 3 we can update the examining authority on progress of those meetings. And we would hope at least we'd be able to say whether, to take the Y fork analogy, whether we're at the stage where we're still discussing, we think there is a way through, or whether discussions have come to a halt and you're going to have to adjudicate.
Yeah.
We hope at least by that stage that form of update could be provided.
That is absolutely critical, because if by deadline 3 we reach a position where it is acknowledged between the parties that there is insufficient common ground and there is so much still in general dispute that you are essentially asking us to adjudicate, then I, as I've already foreshadowed, but I think it's kind of worth providing a little more detail about how that might play out, I would foreshadow that we do have to then look at delivering a very different approach to the hearings that we would hold in April. I think it's fair to say that over lunch we had a conversation where we essentially identified that if we were going to take a fully contended approach to hearings in April, that we did not believe that enough time had been allocated in April for that. And so we would actually foreshadow a need to review the timetable with a view to adding in maybe 2 or even 3 additional hearing days to enable a proper ventilation of contended evidence on both sides, with all that that implies. I mean, that is very, very rare, as everyone in this room will know, in relation to nationally significant infrastructure project examinations. But if we have to do it, we absolutely will. But it will, I foreshadow, take considerably more than the very slender reservation of hearing days that we currently have in April. Does that surprise anybody, or does that sound like it's a sort of fair observation?
Nothing surprises us, sir. Scott Lennon for Vattenfall. No, we understand entirely where the concern comes from, sir. And I think if I can leave it at that, and yep. I mention that, as I said, we will make every effort to engage with the other parties and see if there's any scope for further agreement to be reached, at the very least, to narrow down the issues.
Mr. Owen, any observations on that?
I would agree with that, sir, and certainly if we are in contended territory come April, then I think what you've just said may need to happen is sensible, and as you said, this would be highly unusual, but it might be that you would then receive requests for cross-examination and all that sort of stuff.
Indeed. I mean, again, you know, we did cover that ground in our conversation in the examining authority retiring room at lunchtime, because we certainly felt that if it finally resolved as technical expert witness A against technical expert witness B, and the credibility of each position vis-a-vis the other, yes, we have a discretion to allow cross-examination, and once in my experience as a member of an examining authority, it has been used in circumstances where it was natural environment evidence, but we had a distinct point of credibility between two experts in utter disagreement, and it was used, and it did actually help us to make the final judgment that we had to make about the distinctions between the points raised by two very different experts. So yes, we will consider that. And so looking then finally at what I'm asking for at deadline three, your best positions on progress in order to enable us to make that judgment, and given that we will then have to make a procedural decision, I would, if you are moving down the contended road, what I would also ask for is what would amount to essentially a forward request for the nature of the expert evidence that you would wish to call and the time you believed that would be necessary to bring that witness through their evidence in chief, so that we can then make the judgment about precisely the amount of hearing time to allow. Okay, if everybody's agreed about that, and I'm not seeing any hands raised, let us move with no further ado to agenda item 5. And so if the agenda on screens could follow up. Now then, ladies and gentlemen, if we turn then to agenda item A, this really is the meat in the pudding. We're clear that at issue-specific hearing 2, there was no agreement between the applicant and the assembled interested parties in this room around a definition of adequate C room. Now, essentially, where we are now is in a place where we need to know if there is scope for potential agreement, the nature of conversations that might have been had, and the degree to which there is starting to be any scope for movement on the 50% position that was put in closing by interested parties at issue-specific hearing 2 and then set out in the deadline 1 documents. If the answer to that is a simple and straightforward no, then we can keep this brief. But if there have been technical consultations between parties that are leading to any room for manoeuvre at all, it would be very, very interesting to hear that. What I think I'm going to do is I'm actually going to move to the applicant first, because I would actually quite like to hear whether or not the applicant have any sense of a room for manoeuvre on their position, reserving, of course, their view that they haven't seen adequate evidence from the other side, because that is a matter that can flow through to April, no matter which side of the Y fork we end up travelling in. We can test evidence if additional evidence needs to be tested, but I would very much like to hear from the applicant whether they have, in principle, room for manoeuvre on this.
Scott Lannis for the applicant. Again, Dr. Rogers can add to any of this if he wishes, but when we've looked at the deadline 2 material, and as well as the deadline 1 material, there appear to be sort of some areas where we think there has been a level of agreement reached to our understanding. If I can just run through those very briefly. And the agreement isn't complete, but it looks as if it's there's some headings which can be worked on. And on the first heading, minimum safe distances, if I can put it that way, there was suggestion in some of the London Pilot Council material that the minimum safe distance of 0.5 nautical miles between a ship and an array was an appropriate figure to take. Section 16.1 of the deadline response by the LPC. Now, we know that other parties, such as the PLA, NESL, suggested one nautical mile, but at the very least, we saw at least scope for the beginnings of some kind of, albeit limited, agreement on what the minimum safe distances would be. That's the sort of first point. The second point relates to the sea room on the inshore route, and you'll have received a welter of evidence on various sort of metrics, but as far as vessel size is concerned, as a basis for further discussions, there appears to be a level of agreement with all interested parties, except, to be fair to the ports, because of the position they've expressed today, that a 299-metre length vessel is representative of the largest vessel to transit the inshore route under normal circumstances. Now, we note that there is perhaps a wrinkle in that position with the latest PLA ESL response, but we had taken from their deadline material that a vessel length of up to 250 metres was a reasonable maximum on the inshore route. But from what we can see in the information before us, a vessel size of 299 metres in length overall and a 48-metre beam was going to be a reasonable basis upon which to consider vessels in the inshore route. That's the second point. The third point relates to wider sea room calculations. And the panel will have noticed that in the London Pilot Council material, there is a methodology set out which is based on calculations to determine sea room width that is drawn from MGN 543. Now, a different vessel size is taken into account by LPC for the purposes of coming up with a figure for necessary sea room. But as you'll have seen from our deadline to responses, that we have taken on board that methodology to try and calculate an area of sea room based on the maximum size vessel that I've alluded to already. And we think there may well be merit in the parties looking at that methodology as a basis for further discussions on sea room in the inshore route, based on the fact there appears to be some level of agreement on the vessel side that should be inputted into that methodology. So we see at least the basis for further discussions to take place there, and we welcome some input from other parties as to whether or not that's a reasonable basis for the future meetings to take place. The next heading, sir, is dipping traffic to take a pilot to the route for that. And again, we've taken from the material that's in front of us that a relevant vessel size to consider as part of any discussions was 299 metre length overall with a 40 metre beam. That appears to be some level of agreement with interested parties, except for the ports and London Gateway, that a vessel of that size is representative of the largest vessel to transit that route. So, again, based on that measurement, when it comes to sea room calculations in relation to the Northeast Spit Racon mark and so on, again, separate calculations were provided by the London Pilot Council to determine sea room width based on that size of vessel, and we see some merit in those calculations being used as the basis for further discussions between the parties. So, I think that's where we've made our attempt to see if we can find a way forward in discussions with the other parties. When we have inputted that methodology that London Pilot Council have adopted into the ships that we have assumed, based on the evidence that's been found, we say that tends to show that the inshore route that would be left with our proposals in place would be adequate, and the same would apply further round up to the northwest corner. But if there are any discussions to take place between the parties on whether or not any amendments need to be made to the methodology or the inputs to the methodology, we think that might be an appropriate starting point to try and reach agreement on CRIM.
Okay. Because clearly, if there is the possibility of reaching an agreement on this, then it is the first of a number of dominoes, which then potentially unlock other elements for potential agreement. How far, if anywhere at all, have you got in preliminary conversations with the parties here? I mean, there was reference to a meeting last week, but is this... Are they unsighted on these proposals, or will they at least not a surprise?
They shouldn't come as a surprise. Scotland is for Vattenfall, sir. This approach has been set out in our deadline to response. And the meetings that took place last week, just bear with me, check if this was specifically discussed. But yes. I understand from Mr. Bates that this approach was on slides that were presented at meetings last week. So right. I don't think we've been given any sort of specific comeback, as it were, on this approach, but we certainly have sought to present it to other parties to try and move things forward.
Okay. Now, is there a need, in terms of, before I pass it over for comment and engagement with the other parties, Is there a need to engage not just with a maximum vessel in terms of length, beam and draft that might use the inshore channel, but also to give any particular consideration to the sea room requirements for particular classes or types of vessel? One of the issues that has kind of piqued our antennae a little today is the LNG trade, with the suggestion in a couple of oral submissions there that there was an increase in the number of LNG vessels and that some of them were using the inshore route. And I just wanted to test whether you recognised that to start with, and secondly, if you did, whether there were any arguments that a particular type of vessel with a particular cargo required any additional consideration in terms of adequate sea room.
Scotland, for the applicant, I mean, we're certainly prepared if there was evidence available for that to be considered as part of these discussions. Obviously, that would have to be part of the deliberations, but yes, we're prepared to look at that, sir, yes.
Okay. Right. Is there anything else you want to add before I go around the room and then hear the rest of the room's response to
no,
that?
No, sir, I mean, I say we present this on the basis that it's been one approach that has been taken by London Pilot Council, but obviously we have the other evidence that's been provided, particularly about the so-called issue of buoy hopping, which we say still shows that there would be adequate sea room with the proposals in place. But we're just trying to find a way. We're trying to find a way forward, and we see that as at least a starting point that would enable discussions to take place.
Okay. Well, this might come across as a completely naive and non-starting proposition, but one other slight possibility might be the formal navigation marking of the inshore route as a channel. With port and starboard markers. I don't know whether that would have any merit in it whatsoever. I merely just float it.
Scott Lannis for Vattenfall. We'll certainly take that away, sir. I don't think we can comment.
No,
it now,
I'm not expecting you to if it hasn't been thought of before.
Yes.
But what I would like, by making that point, what I want to illustrate is not that that is necessarily a technically viable solution, because there are people in this room whose expertise is of a nature such that they would probably immediately be able to resolve that it maybe wasn't. But what I am, I think, trying to illustrate is a need for some thinking outside various boxes, and that what might have been viewed as essentially a standard set of solutions, you may find that that solutions might not be in the standard box, and that you might look at some others.
Yes, Scott Lannis for the applicant. So yes, this goes back to a point that I raised at the very outset this morning, that when discussing mitigation, we're not necessarily focusing purely on a change to the red line boundary or a exclusion zone, that all other matters would remain open for discussion by way of mitigation. And if other parties are prepared to consider this as well, then obviously we'll take it away.
Okay, in which case, I'm now then going to go around the room. Mr. Owen, I will come to you first, and then I'll pass around the room in the normal way.
Robbie Owen, thank you, sir. I think we'd particularly like to respond on Mr. Linus's second point about what is felt to be an adequate or fair representation of the length and size of vessels using the inshore route, because as Mr. Crockett referred to earlier, he and colleagues at HR Wallingford have been busy analysing Polaris and AIS data that was provided to us by the PLA a week or so ago. So perhaps, Mr. Crockett, you could take over and just summarise where you are on that.
I'll be very brief. I'd like to just deal with the LNG, because I suspect I'm guilty of
pitching that one in.
Yeah. We actually had a meeting last week, very, very useful meeting, and I actually raised of LNG and mentioned that LNG carriers were not mentioned at all in the NRA, and they're probably mentioned implicitly in the tanker traffic. But generally LNG carriers are differentiated.
Can you just check your microphone,
sorry,
sir?
I didn't put it up. I'll start
the whole thing
again. Thank you. I'm probably guilty of apologies. I'm probably guilty of raising that one. We had a good discussion last week about and indeed they did see the slide of the sea room and that. I actually mentioned LNG carriers because they are often not classed as tankers. Tankers are tankers, and LNG carriers perhaps undeservedly have got a slightly different aura about them. And we have no evidence, and I can't believe that anybody would take an LNG carrier through the inshore route. The important point was that if LNG carriers with their own special requirements, which PLA recognises they have, is that they may lead to changes in traffic patterns in the future, that's all. And they are very large ships, and we know that they do use the northeast spit. So that is factually correct, we know that. A colleague of mine spoke to one on Friday, and he actually confirmed he was about to take an LNG carrier to the northeast spit. So there's no question on that. But so putting that to one side, moving on to the pilot council's point, an accepted technique for finding space, and I alluded to this morning, and I also tried to bring clear our interest in that, would be to actually do a navigation simulation study, a real-time navigation simulation study, using a suite of agreed ships. Not, they don't have to be the right ship, but they can be an agreed ship, and the simulations could take place with and without the wind farm, and they need to take place somewhere that's mutually agreed, where it's neutral territory, and it's a simulation centre that's mutually acceptable, and it's able to model the wind farm, and you would then find that you would get some rigorous data as to what people's perceptions are, both in quantitative terms and qualitative terms, because it is important that experienced mariners will do something in the simulator and they will say, yes, I've done it, but in practice, I would not do that. And I think that rather than trying to do theoretical calculations about sea room, this point is essentially about space. We're calling it sea room, but actually what we're looking about is space, and in particular horizontal space. And it doesn't matter who does it, it really doesn't matter who does it, as long as it's done to a standard that the interested parties and the applicant are happy with it. It may not yield results that we like or anybody else likes, but it would be a correct way to examine the space available. Moving on to the ship, there is there are ships of 330 metres going through that route today, and that's a simple matter of record. And over lunch, I was talking to one of the pilots, and it was basically they have been risk assessed. I think that was the important term, that these ships of 330 metres have been risk assessed for that route. So in other words, somebody's already decided that in the right conditions, we are perfectly happy to take a 330 metre ship through this route, so it really makes very little sense to even be considering a 299 metre ship, and that's probably my bit.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Anything further around that? Okay, in which case, can we move on first to Trinity House and then around the rest of the table?
Trevor Harris, Trinity House. Yes, well, we can agree with the applicant. We did speak last week, and they did show us the calculations provided by London Pilots and under the MGN. We've seen the slides. And we would just like to point out with the slides, they are great within perfect weather conditions, but as was pointed out at our meeting, when considering that, can the applicant please consider adverse weather times as well? You mentioned a prospect of using additional buoyage between the wind farm and the Kent coast at a very early stage. We raised with the applicant that we didn't consider this would be appropriate, because by using buoyage, you not only constrict the available sea room for navigating along, but vessels which would normally navigate outside that channel also tend to use the channel. So again, putting additional pressures on the larger vessels, including the recreational sailors, they seem to stick to channels if they are marked and everything like that. And also, whilst we're discussing the whole thing about thinking outside the box, we mentioned at the meeting last week that we would consider other proposals on the red line boundary. So we are still not sure certain how rigid this existing red line boundary is, not only the side we're talking about reducing, but on the other side, realising the fact that the applicant has picked the shallower water, obviously for economical reasons, it's easier to build the wind farms on, but there could be a possibility to discuss moving the red line boundary on the other side, further out, so the areas can remain the same amount of area, but that is for the written submissions as a possible
okay. mitigation. There is a technical point in relation to examination of NZIP projects that is worth laying on the table at that juncture, and that is that it is distinctly easier to remove land, and I use that as a term inclusive of sea, from a red line boundary, without needing to do something that amounts to a material change to the application in front of the examining authority, than it is to add additional land into the red line boundary that has not previously been there. Because if you do the latter, then you are immediately moving into, in environmental impact assessment terms, the need to study additional land that maybe was not previously studied. And you also have to consider the possibility that prospective interested parties, consultees who were not engaged before because they use that but they don't use what's inside the red line boundary, might also need to be engaged. And so the timescales around doing that as a process make it somewhat more onerous and difficult than essentially giving up land that is already within a red line boundary. That being said, you know, if the applicant wants to make proposals to us, we've probably just about, by the skin of teeth, got enough time remaining within an examination to think about such proposals. But it can't go much longer than the end of next week. It really can't.
Yes, sir. Yes, we do realise that, sir. Thanks very much. Mm.
Okay, now, moving on. MCA and or Coast Guard.
Rakesh Pandit, MCA.
In Trinity House, talked about that meeting. We were also there. It was three of us were there, Trinity House, MCA, and the kind applicants who traveled all the way to MCA to have this meeting. So I quite agree with what Trinity House has already said. And likewise, the point was earlier made about the adequate sea room or adequacy of sea room and as to how difficult it is to quantitatively or qualitatively define it or elucidate it. Sir, even the international conventions, ubiquitous convention like COLREG, doesn't define sea room as such, and for 50 years it has been found okay. It doesn't, and that is within the context of collision avoidance, as I also spoke last week. It doesn't likewise define what is close quarters situation. Some experts put their own opinion on it. When I was learning COLREG, I was told, or I accepted it, as most do, that the close quarter situation is where collision cannot be avoided by action of one vessel alone, which seems to be okay. But again, there's so many ambient and transient weather factors that need to be taken into account. There's so many other variables, ship type, ship length, even the competence of navigators on board, and so on. So what do the navigators do on one vessel or the other? Like we did, like somebody as senior as Captain Barker himself said, we err on the safer side. We had to err on the safer side. So rather than giving exact room, exact sea room, or exact dimensions, we have to go roundabout. And like I said, roundabout, higher margin than a smaller, like I said, we have to err on the safer side. So, which is part of somewhat art of the navigation, I would say, as most of the navigators here may agree or not. Thank you, sir.
Okay, now, moving on. UK Chamber.
Thank you, sir. Fenner Boyle, UK Chamber of Shipping. I'd just like to echo what the MCA have just said. There's no definition of adequate sea room. It is down to the prudent mariner to assess that at the time. And we'd strongly like to see the adverse weather conditions being considered in a bit more detail as well, but also open to discussions on the red line boundaries. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Now,
Alex Dillastone from Wentworth Sherwood for the PLA and ESL. We very much welcomed the applicant taking the initiative to set up the meetings that took place last week. And it is interesting to hear the applicant's characterization of how productive those meetings were. Now, I would ordinarily be very hopeful of reaching technical agreement with an applicant, and the PLA and ESL have done so on similar schemes many times before. We are trying to do so in this case. We have provided ample explanation as to what constitutes adequate sea room, and that is covered in many of the Deadline 1 and Deadline 2 documents. But what was presented at the meeting did not make any appreciable movement towards the PLA or the PSL's position. Indeed, when the applicant was asked whether, and if so, what compromises it would be willing to take, the applicant refused to be drawn on that. Instead, the PLA and ESL were told that we needed to revise our proposals and expectations. So it would be very helpful if, and you will notice a consistent theme here, if the applicant was able to consider ESL and the PLA submissions and make some movements towards reaching an agreement from their side.
I note that point. London Pilots. Ah, apologies, yeah.
Richard Jackson, Estuary Services. Just to go back to the LNG point that was made earlier, is that we have served LNG vessels on the inside, on that inshore channel. And it's quite rare, admittedly, and it's not standard practice, but on the occasion that we can definitely confirm that we served an LNG vessel on the inside, it's because of weather.
And because there's a priority boarding notice put onto LNG vessels because of, usually because of their size and cargo. So there was quite a long-winded, you know, sort of arrangement made between the port, estuary services and the pilot to then draw that vessel onto the inshore route to be able to serve it. But it came in over 11 metre draft. So because there's absolutely no way that we could have served that on the Diamond, or we would have had to be well east of the Diamond. And I would confidently say that given the current extension, that would definitely not happen. I can't see that they would allow us to bring a gas vessel to the east of the Diamond in that sort of proximity to serve a pilot. But from an estuary services point of view, I think where, as we talked about before with the disconnect, I think where that still very much exists is that an awful lot of this conversation about shipping and sea room is to do with passage and not to do with the handling of vessels to ship and land pilots. Mm. And so often, and again, it's been referenced when when there's the interpretation of the LPC's sea room document and the rate of turn, and so allowing for these distances, again, it sort of shows the lack of understanding of where estuary services is, because they've given the rate of turn for the MSC Antigua, and that rate of turn crosses over the Diamond. The MSC Antigua came in on that specific run. She was 11.2 metre draft. She would never have been that far west, you know, and if she was, then we'd be in a lot of trouble. So, and then on the same document, later on, they show the actual passage of the MSC Antigua, and it is set far further east. So I think the understanding of just how estuaries deals with the volume of traffic is still missing. I think our concern would be, given the time frame that's coming up now, is whether or not so many of these points can sort of come to a, we understand where you are, you understand where we are position. I think that's our concern going forward, is that we have so many small points, a lot of them questions more than actual complaints, but of how things have been interpreted with the way that estuary services deals with sea room. Mm. You know, our requirement for sea room has been far more prudent. You say, you know, we've asked for probably more than most, but that's because from our attitude, we're thinking we're going to come to work and we're going to be dealing with multiple vessels in one area, and how we're going to keep those guys away from each other and how we're going to keep it all safe. So I think it's one of the reasons why we've asked probably for the most sea room. Mm. And for one of the larger buffers, is because we're having to do the most manipulation of traffic. This isn't just passage. We're not involved in passage.
So essentially, it is an estimation of sea room driven by your own experience and need.
Yes. Yes. Our request for those sort of sizes is purely based on the fact that we've been there on numerous occasions. And again, this only comes down to experience and the anecdotal side of the evidence. But even we've struggled. In the pilotage study, there's a reference to the Astrid Schulte, and it gives the footprint of the run, which was 13.5 kilometres. And even we couldn't understand why it took us so long to serve that ship. So it confused us as well. But so you've got this one ship, it's a 300-metre vessel, and, of course, when you actually then dig back through all the logs, it's because the visibility that day was one cable, and she was a 300-metre ship. And there were five other ships on that run. Mm. And suddenly it all makes sense. But presented in the pilotage study, it just says, well, you know, there's this ship, it took loads of room, but there's no real reason for it. But actually, because this was pointed out in the early stages, so when it comes down to the sort of concept of saying there's no evidence for your request to sea room, I've told you all this. This has all been said before. Mm. So, you know, we're quite happy to come back, quite happy to go through it all again. It's just that awareness that it's going to take a long time to sort of perhaps get our heads around where we are. Mm.
So you're essentially there raising a caveat about the practical or the practicability of being able to negotiate and broker an agreed settlement in the time remaining.
Yes. I'm just saying it can't be done. But I'm just saying I think it's going to take a lot more than a couple of hours meeting to really... I mean, I think we can certainly understand each other's position, but I don't think there can be any sort of point where it's going to take a lot of work for an NRA to come through and say, OK, estuary services, perhaps you're too sensitive to risk, perhaps you can work in a smaller area, and so therefore, you know, you should be accepting an increase in risk. I, you know, that's that's the bit we think will take a time, particularly as, of course, the NRA's data, which we've got concerns about, is one of the things we really can't address in such a small time frame. Mm. You know, to try and reevaluate the fact that a 28-day traffic survey just doesn't feel adequate to us. So we're a little bit concerned that how we're going to address that input into the NRA, you know, and be satisfied that perhaps there is representation of everything that goes on at the Spit to, you know, in such a short time frame. But having said that, there's a lot of other issues that possibly could be, you know, sort of better understood.
Well, look, I do think that there is an important point emerges from this, which is that just as we have essentially asked for the use of a common ground process, that it also assists an examining authority to have as much clarity as can be given on uncommon ground as well. So if it appears that there are matters that, you know, no progress can be made upon but yet are still of critical importance from the standpoint of the applicant or any interested parties here, again, we would very much like that to be bullet pointed out, at least, so that we are able to form a judgment about the balance of that which is still in dispute, with a view from yourselves that it's going into that list of, you know, disputed matters, because, you know, you cannot find a way forward, or alternatively, the timescales do not sensibly allow a way forward, because you've looked at the work programme to address it, and it takes you months rather than weeks. Yeah. So that would be useful if all parties will note that need to document both that which is agreed and that which cannot be for reasons. Okay.
LPC.
Yes, I know, I'm going to LPC, and then I'm going to the applicant. Does that bring you to a conclusion, ESL?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay.
Oh, yes.
London Pilots Council.
Yeah, Andy Syme, London Pilots Council. So, is it possible to put that up on the screen?
Yes.
Part of my submission?
Do we have a...
It's contained within the LPC submission.
LPC submission.
Yep.
Deadline one.
Deadline one LPC submission, yeah. And... There we go, and there we go.
That's it.
Now, if we can just expand it, perfect.
Would it help if I used a pointer pen?
By all means, yes. Do you want a laser pointer?
Yes,
we've got one here. And if Mr. Alford can just find you a roving microphone as well. The microphone will be on its way shortly. Whoops.
Yeah, thank you very much. First of all, I'd just like to describe the turning data that was mentioned by the applicant there. And table two was actually a table for turning circles for vessels. Turning circle means that when you start to turn the vessel to reverse its heading at various speeds and at various depths of water, the amount of time and the distance it takes to turn that vessel. Each vessel has a turning circle in shallow and deep water, and a number of my colleagues have been compiling data for me, which hopefully will go in our next submission into required sea room. And just to put it into context, this was a 220-metre container ship, 8.5 metres draft. Its turning circle was 1.1 nautical miles. And then if you see that that ship then boards at the diamond here, and it's on an easterly course, then we have something like 12 minutes to actually get on board that ship and turn it round. And about takes 5 to 6 minutes from the pilot boat to turn the ship to actually get it to the bridge. So that's where we put an estimated 6 cables on. So in actual fact, the ship takes something in the region of about 1.6 miles from turning it round. So it's out here somewhere before we can actually take it up east of the Northeast Spit Raycon and out. So the figures of 6 times the ship's length plus 6 cables for 6 minutes to get on board is the safe room required to turn that vessel, not the safe sea room. You can see that down at the Northeast Spit Diamond here to the end of the edge of the exclusion zone is only 1.2 miles. What that means is that if you board a ship on the boarding diamond here, anything from class 4, that's 120 metres by 6 metres draft, can quite comfortably go across the Northeast Spit. Class 3, well, depending on the state of the tide, it can transit to the west of the Northeast Spit Raycon, but further out to the northeast of it, obviously not across the shallow water. A lot of these vessels are tide restricted, so if it was suggested that mitigation measures manage traffic across there, I think we were looking at then ship delays, which has its own economic impact upon different ports. Across here, we have 1.4 metres from the Northeast Spit Raycon to the edge of the exclusion zone. Nautical miles. Nautical miles. Yeah.
I thought that sounded a little small.
Just bring you back to our last hearing, I did point this out as a choke point to everybody, and I said that we'd end up with something like 0.9. And where we get this figure from, that when we bring a ship in, we simply can't go up there to that point there and then turn round. We need something in the region of between 3 and 6 cables, that's 0.3 and 0.6 of a mile, to start that turn. So you'd actually be out here somewhere to the southeast with a 10-degree rate of turn for 6 cables, and then you'd end up around here by the time you've got the ship on the required heading in. And that 0.6 from the 1.4 gives us 0.8, 0.9 of a cable choke point, bearing in mind that all of the vessels with the sort of the term is being used quite often, dip down for pilots. So that is a very busy traffic route of vessels coming in for the pipe to board a pilot and then out again. So we've got significant reduced sea room for outbound vessels or large vessels of the 250-metre type that the applicant spoke about. Critical to all this is the anchorage here. And when we look for sea room, we're looking at the moment, we have about 2.8 nautical miles, to the existing wind farm exclusion zone. And it's difficult to say what the safe sea room is, but one thing is for sure, this area here where ships are coming in and ships are coming out, that's the area where we have most conflict and close quarters situations here. And unfortunately, we've got sort of 1.2 to 1.4 miles of sea room. And so it's this area where we've just compacted the sea room, we've increased the risk of collision, increased the risk of close quarters situations. And bearing in mind that the collision regs require us that in terms of conflict, the normal protocol is to go to starboard. And we just really, between 0.9 and 1.4 nautical miles, we don't have the available sea room to avoid risk of collision if there's more than two vessels. I think that's basically about all I need to say. Thank you.
Thank you. In which case, let's go back to Mr. Lyons.
I'll ask Ed Rogers to pick up on a response to that. But it would be helpful, again, trying to sort of focus where any meetings might take place in the future, that the evidence we've heard appears to focus concern on essentially sea room in the northwest corner. And it would be helpful for us to know when we're planning sort of further engagement with LPC and others, is that essentially the focus of concern? Because we have the inshore route, we have pilot boarding, and we have sea room in that area in the northwest. And would help us to understand if that's essentially what the focus of the concern is. But I can ask Mr. Rogers to respond to the evidence that we've heard before we hear anything further from LPC on that anyway.
Ed Rogers for the applicant. In going through the deadline one responses, we've tried to break out the issues into three distinct issues. Issues associated with the inshore route, issues associated with pilot boarding, and issues with vessels dipping down from the north to take a pilot. The calculations that we've undertaken relate to those different activities. We think that they show that to the southwest, the inshore route at the bottom, the sea room, is sufficient based on those calculations. There was some discussion here about taking on board adverse metocean conditions in terms of visibility and maybe times of high wind, wave, or swell, which I think we can look at. The issues around pilot boarding and sea room necessary for that are different compared to the issues of through vessel transits. In our deadline one submission, we presented a number of different plots that tried to split out the different activities of vessels as they navigate either through the inshore route or from the north to pick up a pilot out. It's probably interesting to note that the individual largest vessel that we have on the data set available to us actually transited to the west of the northeast bit Raycon buoy as a vessel that was transiting the inshore route. Now, that's just one particular vessel. That was a draft of 10.1 metres. It was clearly going somewhere on a tidal cycle. With what we've heard to date, I don't yet understand whether the calculations we put forward are agreed upon or not agreed upon in terms of our deadline two submissions. And I think one of the things we've tried to look at in the meetings that we had last week was, is there a method by which we can get to some agreement? Because
indeed,
at the moment, we are open, I think, the applicant is open to changes or further mitigations. The applicant's already made two changes to the red line boundary. One of the things I would like to point out and we don't want to go back over old ground, but the pilot bridge simulation was undertaken on the old red line boundary. It isn't the boundary that we're currently working to. So any discussions about marginal aspects of a particular run was against a boundary that's not in place at the moment. If there is a way or a mechanism, a calculation that can be undertaken that all parties would be happy to feed into, then we would certainly be open to discussing that in more detail.
I mean, in that respect, one of the issues that's crossing my mind is whether, if on agreement of any practical change to the RLB, there is the ability to rerun the bridge simulation or indeed any other aspect of input to the NRA, so that there is clarity that the RLB that is actually being proposed is the thing that is actually being tested. Because I'm conscious that if, you know, we're already in a world where that work was done in relation to the RLB prior to the change, conversations might be happening that lead to further changes. And in terms of giving the Secretary of State confidence, for example, that navigation risk issues had been satisfactorily addressed, if that is a road that is progressed to by way of agreement, one question that I can almost guarantee might be asked in the Secretary of State's office is, well, you know, does this navigation risk assessment address the red line boundary as currently seen, or does it address it two iterations ago? And I think there'll be considerably greater confidence if it addresses what it actually is now, or indeed might be in the future.
Yes. Scott Linus for the applicant. Sir, yes, we'll take that away. I mean, I think what we could say at present, if, we'll underline if as many times as we can, if there was a position where some form of agreement looked possible, I think we would envisage some form of at least sort of qualitative review of the NRA that would reflect any proposals that were agreed with the other parties, if that were to be achieved. We would need to think about exactly what that would involve, but we would understand that in the event that any alterations were advanced, as I said, we're not there yet, but you would need something to explain what the impact of those was on the material that was already before the examining authority. And we could see the benefit of some form of explanation as the effects of any such change on the conclusions of the NRA. I don't think we can say at this stage what exactly that would involve, but we understand the need to provide something to tie in any agreed measures with the conclusions of the NRA.
Okay. Now, I was conscious I interrupted you, so are there other matters that you wish to draw to our attention before you conclude?
No other matters. No, okay. Thank you.
Thank you. In which case, I think we have given a very thorough ventilation to agenda item 5A, and it is the first at which... apologies.
Sorry, it's just one point, just to the question you raised about are we just looking at the northwest or the southwest, but... Okay. Richard Jackson, Estuary Services, sorry. We would, Estuary Services certainly would want to see the southwest given as much consideration as the northwest. Partly because anything you do that does affect traffic to the southwest will then have an inevitable knock-on effect to the northwest, and the two do sort of interplay with each other. We do have traffic that passes through there that comes to us, and we also have... there are occasions when restrictions are put into service where actually the only area we do work is around the Elbow Buoy. So I think we would still want to see the whole area, not just a focus on the northwest.
Okay. Taking all of the oral submissions that we've heard then in relation to Agenda 5A, it does appear that there is at least a starting platform from which certain conversations about possible additional agreement could be made. It appears that there are also substantial reservations and concerns on technical points that require to be dealt with in detail through a process of multi-party meetings, I would suggest. There is also a concern formally expressed on behalf of Port of London Authority and Estuary Services Limited that the time remaining for the brokerage and documentation of formal agreement is very, very tight. And I think all of those things need to be acknowledged. But nevertheless, it does certainly strike us that if these are matters that can be progressed by deadline three to a point where there is essentially sufficient emerging potential for agreement in a statement of common ground, then there is, as I've indicated, probably just about enough time to enable that agreement to be brought forward and for the examination to take account of the changes that might emerge from it. Now, what I'm then going to suggest is that if we look at the subsequent agenda items in 5B through to F, these are all essentially validation points where we are effectively asking the applicant to respond to interested parties' positions at deadline two. Now, in terms of preparation for potential conversations around common ground, it strikes me that actually enabling the applicant to surface its positions on each of those matters would probably be quite valuable to the parties assembled here. And so what I'm going to suggest we do is if we take those agenda points, each as being led by the applicant on that basis, there will be some individual questions that the examining authority will have. But I think if we hear from the applicant first on each of those and then move to brief responses from the assembled interested parties, at least then the interested parties and the panel will know a little more about the scope for potential areas of movement and potential areas of agreement on each of those items. Does that sound like a sensible way forward?
Scott Leonard for the applicant, yes, sir.
If I can go to Mr. Owen and just then around the room, I see nods everywhere. In which case, I'm then going to suggest that we break. It is 4 o'clock. Can we resume at 4:20? And we will go through the rest of those items. And on that basis, it feels as though we're back almost on track. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.